Chapter 21. The next day, Ross arrived at the police station early, but the boss was still there before him, doing the things that most senior officers wouldn't think to do themselves. Filling the coffee machine, setting out the chairs in the ops room. Ross knew Venn's willingness to muck in was admirable, but it made him uncomfortable. He liked his boundaries to be clear, to know where he stood. Besides, he was ambitious. One day he'd be a DI, and he wouldn't want to be concerned with the trivia of an investigation. He was anxious that Venn might be setting an unfortunate precedent. Jen Rafferty flew in at the last minute, red hair flying. Ross had got to know her better when they'd worked on the Simon Walden murder, but he still found her tricky. She was too opinionated, too dismissive of his ideas, too willing to side with the scroats, too emotional altogether. Venn stood at the front. Ross always thought he looked like an undertaker. It was the understated dark suits, worn sometimes even in this weather, and the shiny black shoes, the sombre, thoughtful manner, the hair, already quite grey. Venn had started talking. "Two murders," he said. "Nigel Yeo and Wesley Curnow, connected through the community at Westercombe Farm." A pause. "Of course, the press will have a field day with this. I've already seen one of the national tabloid headlines, Double Murder on Sunshine Coast. But we have to ignore that sort of speculation. The victims were individuals and they have families. They deserve our respect. However, we'll obviously be looking for connections. These killings weren't random or coincidental." Ross tried not to yawn. He wished Venn would get to the important stuff. His boss was still talking. "Nigel Yeo worked for an organization called North Devon Patients Together, or NDPT. I've checked his diary, and on the morning of his death, he had a meeting with three individuals who worked in the hospital. I've arranged to see them today. There was a possibility that Dr. Yeo had found evidence of negligence or lack of care in the treatment of a young man with a mental health illness who went on to kill himself. That man was called Alexander McKenzie, and he provides another link with the second victim, because his sister, Janie McKenzie, was a friend of Wesley Curnow's. They were together on the evening before Mr. Yeo's body was found." Venn looked round at the room to check that everyone had understood the importance of the information and the complexity of the relationships. This time Ross did yawn. It was like being back at school. "We can assume that both men drove themselves to the places where they were found. The pathologist has confirmed that both were killed at the scenes. So, were they lured to some fictional meeting? We still haven't found either man's mobile phone." Venn looked out at the room. "Ross, I know you've had information from Yeo's service provider, but can you follow up with Wesley Curnow's? I'd like you with me for the meeting in the hospital, but they can't see us until 9:30.
"Sure, boss."
He tried to sound eager. Jen Rafferty stuck up her hand. "I've dug up some interesting info on Roger Pryor, the CEO of the Health Trust, husband to Cynthia who hosted the party on Friday night." Venn was interested. "He's one of the people we've arranged to see. He was forced to resign from a big trust in London after an inquiry following the suicide of a teenager with mental health problems. The report failed to hold any individual responsible, but Pryor was blamed by implication in the press and he was hounded on social media. The suicide occurred in the hospital, and you can see why he wouldn't want another scandal."
"Indeed."
Venn shut his eyes for a moment. It was impossible to tell what he made of this news.
"Thanks, Jen. Can you get all the relevant information across to me? I'll read it before the meeting. And of course, copy Ross in."
Oh, great, Ross thought. An hour of reading boring background information, which will turn out to be irrelevant, and chasing mobile phone records. Just what I joined the police for. Not.
"Sure," Jen said. "I was thinking I'd speak to the mother of the lad who committed suicide in Camden. His name was Luke Wallace. I'm sure I can track her down and get a few more details."
Venn nodded.
"Good plan. But before that, I'd like you to speak to the McKenzie family. See if you can talk to them all together. Martha, the actress mother, is home at the moment. Get a feel for what's going on there. I'm not after witness statements just yet. I can't see they'd have a motive to kill either man, but somehow they're at the heart of this case."
"I've been a regular at the Sandpiper, though I'm not close to the family.
Are you still happy for me to do that? In the moment before Ven answered, Ross held his breath, hoping that he and Jen might be asked to swap roles, let her do the phones and sit with the suits in the hospital. He wouldn't mind seeing Janie again. He imagined sitting in the bar by the beach, chatting over coffee, getting to understand her better while picking up a detail vital to the case. But the inspector only smiled. Most of us have been in the Sandpiper at some time or another. I'm sure we can trust you to keep it professional. He looked out at the room. Anyone got anything else to contribute? Ideas, information? Anything that I might have overlooked? Ross stood up. When I chatted to Janie McKenzie yesterday, I asked about the car Curnow saw driving very fast down his lane. She hadn't seen anything when she dropped Wesley off, but she said that when she was walking from the bar to her home, a vehicle drove at speed through the village. Any description? Ross shrugged. Something big and black. Jen stuck up her hand. Roger Pryor drives a black SUV. Ven smiled. Useful to know, but so do many of our residents and most of the visitors to the county. Vicky, could you go back through the CCTV? Any other contributions? There was silence, and after a pause, Matthew Ven went on. We'll need good routine policing then. Thanks to Vicky, we have a record of Nigel Yeo's car in the service station just outside Insto on the night before his body was discovered. Jen, could you check in with the staff there? See if anyone remembers seeing him. And besides checking for our mysterious black SUV in Insto in the early hours of Saturday morning, let's look at the roads coming into Barnstable yesterday afternoon. If we can find the same vehicle in both places, we might just have hit the jackpot. I'd like to fix a time for Curnow's arrival at the Woodyard, and CCTV might give us that answer too. He looked up again. One more thing. Yeo was in a relationship with a colleague, a woman called Lauren Miller. Thanks for the heads up on that, Ross. Let's see if you can get an equally speedy result on Wesley's mobile records. He collected his papers into a neat bundle and walked away to his office. The hospital was on a slight hill. It was on the edge of the town, but surrounded by trees, so it had the air of being in the country. Ross and Ven waited in a queue at reception behind a wheezing elderly man and a woman with a screaming kid. Ross thought he and Mel might start a family sometime. Mel mentioned it occasionally in a kind of dreamy, wistful voice. But of course, any child of theirs would be well behaved. It wouldn't scream or have tantrums in public. That sort of thing was down to the parents, wasn't it? And Mel would be a brilliant mother. He thought they should jump the queue by flashing their warrant cards, but Ven seemed to have endless patience. At last, they reached the desk and the receptionist pointed them to a square building separate from the main hospital. They're in the admin block. Three people were waiting for them in a long, airy room with a view of the car park. There was a tall, older, black-haired man and two women, one sleek and middle-aged, one younger, Asian. The group sat at one end of a rectangular table and looked, Ross thought, like an interviewing panel. It was clear that they had met earlier to discuss tactics, to come up with a shared position. His mother had always given doctors godlike status, and Ross felt suddenly nervous, as if he were the one to be interrogated. Ven introduced himself and took a seat close to the group. This is Ross May, one of my team. Ross nodded and took out his notebook. He wasn't expecting to speak, but the boss would want a detailed record of the meeting. Ross had anticipated that the guy would take charge, but it was the older woman who stood to greet them.
Fiona Radley, head of comms. These are my colleagues, Roger Pryor, CEO of the Trust, and Ratna Joshi. She's the psychiatrist who worked most closely with Alexander McKenzie, and I understand you have some questions about his care.
Of course, we're all deeply upset by Nigel's death, Pryor said. He was a valued colleague before he retired to work with patients together. He had many friends here, and he'll be sorely missed. Please pass on our condolences to his daughter. Ross thought this sounded like a rehearsed speech. You were a personal friend too, I understand, Ven said. The statement seemed to make Pryor uncomfortable.
He was a neighbour. My wife and I supported him after the death of his wife.
Ross decided Pryor was the kind of witness who'd never give a straight answer. He hated that.
I'm sorry, Inspector,
The head of PR had a shrill voice. But I think we should stick to the clinical facts here.
The clinical facts are that Dr. Yeo was stabbed to death by a personal persons unknown, and that the three of you saw him on the morning before he died. The room fell silent. Fiona Radley took a tissue from her handbag and sneezed.
Sorry, she said. Hay fever.
Ven ignored her. What did you discuss at that meeting?
I think you know, Inspector. Dr. Yeo had asked for the meeting because he was looking into the suicide of one of our patients.
Radley paused.
I'm sure you won't expect us to pass on details of a confidential conversation.
Ven ignored the question and asked one of his own. Was Dr. Yeo aware that Mr. Pryor had resigned from his previous post in North London following a similar scandal? Silence descended again before Ven continued. Because that was a matter of public record and not at all confidential. This time, Pryor responded.
There was a serious case review, Inspector, and both the Trust and I were cleared of any blame.
The words were trotted out as if he'd said them many times before.
It wouldn't look good, though, if you were caught up in a similar incident.
Radley came in again, smooth and composed.
Nigel was concerned that our procedures hadn't been strictly followed. Alexander had been sectioned under the Mental Health Act after being brought to A&E by one of your officers. He was admitted to Gorse Hill, our acute psychiatric hospital. The following morning, we decided that he had capacity to make his own decisions and allowed him to discharge himself.
A pause.
At the meeting on Friday morning, we were able to reassure Dr. Yeo that, in fact, the guidelines had been strictly followed. He seemed satisfied by the explanation.
And yet, Ross thought. That evening he went to a party, held by the wife of the Trust's CEO, especially to talk to a detective sergeant about the case. The facts don't quite hang together.
Who took the decision to allow Mr. McKenzie to discharge himself?
Ven's voice hadn't changed in tone. There was no judgment, just a mild inquiry.
I did.
This was the younger woman, Ratna Joshi. She was slight, dressed in black trousers and a gold silk blouse.
Dr. Joshi is a registrar in Gorse Hill.
This was Radley again, trying to keep control.
Newly appointed, Joshi said.
She had a North Country accent and the words were sharp, uncompromising. In charge of the unit over the weekend, with two more emergency admissions to process and no beds. Mac had a family who cared for him. I thought it would be safe to discharge him into community support.
She looked up and stared at Ven. But of course, the community team was as stretched as we were.
So he fell through a gap in the service.
Something like that, the young doctor said. Didn't help that until his 18th birthday he'd been treated as a child, so there wasn't a continuity of care. But Nigel wasn't interested in apportioning individual blame. He said the NDPT wanted to check that there was no systemic problem and that it wouldn't happen again. The family had talked about going to the media.
Radley was becoming impatient.
The last thing the NHS needs is more bad press and for a poorly resourced sector to have to pay out huge sums in compensation. We explained to Nigel that we'd improved our service as a result of Alexander's death. I think he accepted that. I hoped that he'd be willing to explain our change of procedure to the Mackenzies.
And was he? Ven asked. Was he willing to talk to the family on your behalf?
I had the impression that his view on the matter had mellowed a little. He was at least listening to our arguments.
She looked at her colleagues.
I'd say we parted on good terms. Wouldn't you agree?
Pryor nodded vigorously. Joshi said nothing. Were minutes taken?
No. Radley again. It wasn't a formal meeting.
A pause.
Are you implying that you don't believe our account of events?
I'm not implying anything, Ven said. But a record of the conversation would have been useful. A pause. Did Dr. Yeo give any indication of how he intended to proceed with his investigation?
No.
Ven nodded but made no response. Instead, there was another question. How did Dr. Yeo appear to you at your meeting? Did he seem distracted, anxious?
Radley thought for a while. Not anxious, she said. I can't imagine Nigel being anxious about anything. But perhaps he was a little distracted. I thought that he might have had other things on his mind.
His diary showed that he had another meeting at the hospital later in the day. Would you know who that was with?
Radley shook her head. But of course I can try to find out for you, Inspector.
A bright professional smile. She was being very helpful, Ross thought, now the focus had shifted away from Pryor.
At the end of the meeting, Venn said, perhaps you talked about other, less formal things, plans for the evening, for the weekend.
No, Radley said. I'm sorry, there was nothing like that.
They looked at Venn to check that the interview was over. Roger Pryor started gathering together the files on the desk in front of him. Ross thought they were relieved. It was as if this had been less disturbing than they'd been expecting. There was a sense of relaxation, a release of tension. Venn was already on his feet, too. Just one more thing. The words caught them all, froze them, so they posed like statues, waiting for the question, dreading it, perhaps. There were some numbers in Dr. Yeo's diary. 8531 or 8537. They were smudged and not quite legible. Did they mean anything to you? Could it be a file number, a patient number? Ross sensed relief again. The question hadn't troubled them. Pryor answered immediately. I'm sorry, no. I have no idea at all what that could mean. Certainly not anything related to Nigel's work here at the hospital. They were walking back to the vehicle when they heard footsteps running behind them. It was Ratna Joshi, the young psychiatrist, light on her feet in black ballet pumps. Her hair was in a long plait down her back and it swung as she ran. They were on a tarmac path leading through the car park in full sunlight. The heat bounced off the hard surfaces, and in places the asphalt had melted and was sticky underfoot. The woman was slightly breathless after the run.
There's something you should know. I didn't want to say it in the meeting. Fiona told us only to answer questions, not to volunteer information.
Go on. Venn had stopped and turned towards her.
I saw Nigel on Friday after we had that meeting. It was early evening. I'd finished for the day and I was on my way out. We bumped into each other in the corridor.
So he'd definitely come back to the hospital. There must have been another meeting.
Or he'd stayed on all day to see people in different departments. Something routine. He was here quite often.
Of course we'll check that out. Ms. Radley did say that she'd help. Venn smiled at her. How did Dr. Yeo seem?
He was angry, Ratna said. Furious. I'd never seen him like that. Nigel was usually a calm presence. He said he wasn't going to be silenced. The truth had to be told.
Chapter 22. The sandpiper was closed all day on Mondays. Our one day of rest, George said, when Jen called to make an appointment. Yes, we'll all wait in to speak to you. Come to the house. That's where we'll be. The house was whitewashed, and like the cafe bar next door, it faced the sea, only separated from the beach by the narrow road. There was a wrought iron balcony on the first floor, and that was where Martha was standing when Jen parked outside. She was leaning against the rail, holding a cigarette in one hand, blowing the smoke towards the shore. Martha McKenzie had been part of Jen's childhood. The soap she had acted in for more than 30 years had been required early evening TV viewing, and despite herself, Jen was aware of the woman's celebrity. There was a thrill in meeting someone so famous. You must be the detective. Martha's voice was deep and it carried. A woman walking past with a buggy turned to stare. She recognized Martha too and gave an excited little wave. Martha waved back, graciously. Just a mo and I'll be down to let you in. The young mother looked at Jen with a touch of envy and walked on. Jen had seen Martha before in the bar, a glamorous presence with a small crowd around her, but they'd never been introduced. It seemed Martha recognized her, though.
Of course, you're Wesley's chum. Poor Wesley. You must be devastated. We all are.
She reached out and gave Jen a hug, surrounding her with the smell of cigarette and expensive perfume. Jen wondered what Venn would say about an interview beginning with such informality. But then he told her to put the family at their ease. Eventually, Martha pulled away.
Come on through. The others are still finishing breakfast, but I was desperate for a ciggy.
The kitchen was long and narrow and ended in double glass doors leading onto a patio garden with terracotta pots and rough stone walls covered with climbing plants. One shelf ran right along the room's longest wall. It had been painted yellow and held strange trinkets, bits of brightly coloured pottery and glass, shells, tiny carvings that might have been made by Wesley. The doors were open, so the kitchen and the garden seemed like one space. George and Janie sat inside at a light wood table. There was a jug of coffee, a plate with a remaining single croissant.
We have a late breakfast on Mondays, Martha said. It's become rather a ritual.
Janie looked up and gave a little smile. Jen thought she might be about to say something, but in the end she continued to stare into her mug. She seemed exhausted, blank.
George stood up and held out his hand. Jen, he said, how lovely to see a friendly face. I worried they might send a stranger.
This isn't a formal interview, Jen said. That will probably come later because you all knew both victims, and I won't be allowed to take part in that. This is an initial chat to see if you might be able to help.
Her attention was caught again by the yard outside. You've made it so beautiful here.
That was Mac, Janie said. His design, his work. You should have seen it when we first moved in. We're trying to keep it going for him, but none of us has his green fingers.
George was still on his feet, pouring coffee.
Would you like anything to eat? That croissant won't be so nice now, but I can make you toast. Eggs, maybe.
Speaking with the Scottish accent that had always set him apart. Jen shook her head.
I'm afraid I have questions.
Of course you do, darling, Martha said. That's why you're here.
Did either of you see Wesley yesterday? You were friends. Perhaps he called in?
I didn't see him, George said. One of my chefs was off sick and I was in the kitchen for most of the day. I hardly went into the bar at all, except to cover for Janie when she went off to speak to your colleague.
Your staff will be able to confirm that.
You're asking if I have an alibi?
He sounded amused, unoffended.
We close early on a Sunday. There are so many places here serving Sunday lunch, and we don't feel the need to compete. So our regulars come for breakfast or brunch, and we close in the early afternoon. I have an alibi until then, and one of your officers came to talk to Janie. After that, no.
Where did you go?
I drove inland, George said. I wanted to get away from the crowds for a bit. There's a place near Torrington where Mac loved to walk. He was a great walker. Seal Point was his favourite place, but I knew that would be packed on a Sunday afternoon, so I headed inland instead. I got back at about 6.
It seemed a long explanation to a simple question, but George had always been garrulous. Jen turned to his wife.
You didn't want to go too?
The woman smiled. All her features were large, and her smile was generous, wide. She was wearing lipstick. Jen thought about that. The effort of putting on makeup just to be in the house, every day a performance.
Walking's not really my thing. Not in this heat. I went and lay on the bed, dozed for a while. The idea of a siesta is very civilized, don't you think? I didn't wake until George came back.
Throughout the exchange, Janie had been silent, unresponsive. Now she looked up.
I suppose you want to hear about me?
Please. When I came off shift, I had a shower, changed, then I headed out. I wanted to escape this place too. It's crazy in the summer. Sometimes I long for grey days, a storm from the west just to keep people away, pouring rain. I wonder why I ever came home. But I couldn't drive. I'd parked in the lane by the side of the bar and some bastard tourist had boxed me in. I was really, really pissed off, wrote a note and stuck it on his windscreen, made a record of his registration number, thinking I'd dob him into the parking guys. I never did, of course. Couldn't be asked. It seemed a bit petty. In the end, I went for a walk. Out past the cricket club towards Fremington Quay. It was a bit quieter there. Still lots of people about, but not crazy busy.
Do you still have a note of the car's registration number?
Nah, Janie said. At least, probably not.
You might want to look, Jen said. Just in case.
There was a moment of silence while the implication of that sunk in, but there was no response. No righteous indignation. Janie just nodded in agreement.
I'm sure I can dig it out.
And the family just has two vehicles? You don't have your own, Mrs. McKenzie?
No,
the woman said. If I need a car, I use George or Janie's.
You all seem to have been close to Wesley. How did you meet him?
Jen thought the more general question might put them at ease, start a natural conversation.
He was a regular in the bar, George said, and he had a way of making you feel like a friend, of wanting to be his friend.
We run a business, but I found myself buying drinks for him. Just as well he was one of a kind, because we'd have gone under if I treated all my customers as drinking pals.
I'm not sure how close we really were, Janie said. I think at heart he was an actor. It was subconscious. Like you, Mummy. He became the person we all wanted him to be. He was great to have in the bar because he could lift the mood. He'd walk in and suddenly he made everyone feel cleverer, more amusing. But what lay under the charm?
She shrugged.
I don't think we'll ever know now.
Has he upset anyone recently?
Another silence.
This is going to sound very petty, Martha said. Not something that could ever trigger murder.
All the same, Jen said, it would be useful to know. That's why I'm here drinking coffee with you, and we're not taking statements. I'm after background, the gossip.
He had a way of charming middle-aged women. Martha sounded dismissive. Maybe she didn't consider herself middle-aged.
Perhaps he made them feel younger, though he was no spring chicken himself. Wherever he went, they were around him, giggling, buying him meals and drinks. But he had one special admirer, Cynthia Pryor. Of course, you know her.
Jen nodded.
Her husband's a dry old stick who doesn't share any of her interests. Cynthia considered Wesley a sort of cultural companion. She'd think nothing of taking him to London to see a show that interested her, or dragging him round an exhibition. All expenses paid, of course. First-class rail and a fabulous meal at the end of the evening, in return for his company. But recently he'd been seeing a lot less of her. It's possible that Roger finally put his foot down. I don't know him well, but I imagine he's a man who would care about appearances. But I had the impression that Wesley was the one who'd started to keep his distance.
Martha turned to her daughter.
What do you think, Janie? You probably knew Wesley better than the rest of us.
Janie shook her head as if she had no answer.
I don't know what was going on. Like I said before, nobody really understood Wesley Curnow. He was a mystery to us all.
Was he close to Mac?
Jen thought that might be another link between their victims. If the two were friends, Wesley could have been supporting Nigel's campaign to investigate the young man's death.
Wesley didn't really like people who made demands on him, Janie said. It was always the other way around, and depressed people can be very demanding.
I think Mac was hurt because Wes kept his distance during that last episode of illness. When they led him out of hospital, he got in touch with Wes and asked to see him. When there was no reply to his texts and calls, Mac walked up to Westercombe. He was so restless at that time, so impatient. He was pacing, talking to himself, hearing strange voices. Wes just didn't know how to handle a madman landing up on his doorstep. All that real emotion was too much for him. In the end, he phoned me and asked me to take Mac away. Mac was crying all the way home in the car. I suppose it must have seemed like the worst kind of rejection from someone he'd admired and considered a friend. That was the day before he killed himself.
You must have found that very hurtful.
And yet you still hung out with Wesley. You were dancing with him at Cynthia's party?
Not really. I could understand how Wesley found it uncomfortable. I'd probably have reacted in just the same way if Mac hadn't been my brother.
Janie paused.
We're all supposed to be open about mental health these days, very sympathetic. But the reality of the bloody thing, the person's self-obsession, the relentless movement like they're constantly wired, the tedious repetition of paranoid thoughts, that hasn't changed. You can't know just how exhausting severe depression can be for other people until you've experienced it. She looked up. I'm sorry, that sounds callous. It was incredibly painful to deal with. That was why we needed the health professionals, partly just to take over some of the responsibility, to give us hope that they could make Mac better and keep him safe. We couldn't do it anymore. And the health service let us down.
Did any of you feel that Wesley was responsible for Mac's death?
No.
George's response was immediate.
That was the health service. They mismanaged the whole case. I phoned them when Janie brought Mac back from Westercombe in such a state. I phoned his consultant. His secretary said he'd phone us back, but of course, he didn't. I phoned the community support team. Again, nothing. Apparently, my son wasn't sufficiently suicidal to warrant immediate intervention. And he had family support. The hospital had prescribed medication to help Mac sleep, and we gave it to him that evening and made sure he was in bed. We thought he was asleep. The next day was Monday, our day off, and the rest of us were later getting up than usual. As Janie said, we were all exhausted. When we woke up, there was no sign of Mac. Maybe he hadn't swallowed the pills, or maybe they weren't as strong as we'd imagined. We all went to look for him, frantic. You can't imagine what it was like. I still have nightmares. Then we discovered that he'd taken his car.
Who found his note?
Some holidaymaker, Janie said. Dad called the police when we realised Mac's car was missing and they found it outside our chalet in the dunes. His body didn't turn up until several days later. Washed ashore on the north end of Lundy, pulled out by the tide.
When George turned to face Jen, there were tears running down his face, and when he spoke, the words were sharp and jagged.
That wasn't Wesley's fault. He wasn't trained in mental health. It wasn't even the fault of the poor sods who let him discharge himself too soon and then were too overstretched to respond when he had a crisis. It was the system. And I want the whole world to know how it let my son down.
Jen didn't know what to say. She'd been in the bar a couple of times since Mac's death. George had been his usual urbane self, accepting the condolences of regulars with a hug of thanks, a few grateful words. There'd been none of this anger. Now, she thought he must be as fine an actor as his wife, to have persuaded them all that he'd accepted the death of his son with grace. She got to her feet.
I don't want to disturb you all any further, but I wonder if I could chat to Janie.
Jen turned to the woman.
It sounds as if you were as close to Wesley as anyone. We could go into Instow, get a coffee.
She thought there were things she'd never want to say in front of her parents.
Sure,
Janie said. Then, after a moment's thought, she added, her voice tentative,
Could we go to Seal Bay? Have a little walk on the point? It was Mac's happy place. I was planning to go this morning. It won't be so busy today.
Martha put her arm around her daughter's shoulder.
Are you sure, darling? Couldn't that just bring everything back?
Janie tensed under the touch.
Don't you think these murders haven't brought it back already? The nightmares, the flashbacks. I kept waking up last night. I'd drift back and be haunted again.
Her voice was angry, bitter, and Jen saw that the young woman's hands were trembling. She couldn't imagine what it must be like, to be reminded over and over of the loss of a brother.
There's nothing I'd like better than a wander by the sea in the line of duty, Jen said. And we'll get an ice cream. My treat.
They parked by the Mackenzies' chalet, but they didn't go inside. The building was made of wood and the paint was peeling. It was less grand and impressive than some of the others, but Jen could see how it would appeal to a couple of kids. It would be the best kind of den. Janie led her through the dunes, across the beach and onto the coastal path. They didn't start talking until they were on their own, facing out to the sea. It was as smooth as oil, glittering in full sunlight. As Janie had said, the path was relatively quiet.
Tell me a bit more about Wesley, Jen said. How close were you?
But Janie had stopped where the cliff was closest to the water and was looking out towards Lundy on the horizon.
This is where they found the note that Mac left for us.
What did it say?
That he needed to find peace at last.
Janie looked back at Jen.
I feel like that now. These murders. It's like blow after blow, as if you've been mugged and someone's kicking you over and over again. Just as you think it's all over, they come back to hit you. You're not feeling suicidal, though? There was a moment's hesitation before she answered.
Nah, don't worry. I'm a survivor. Poor Mac wasn't.
So, tell me about Wesley, if you feel that you're up to talking about it. If it's not one kick too many.
Yeah, I'm okay. It's good to get away from the house. We've all been affected by Mac's death in different ways. Mum and Dad are all like, we've got to keep the show on the road. It'll get to them sometime, though.
I think it's already got to them. They just have different ways of dealing with it.
Maybe.
Janie was still staring out to sea. Lundy was shimmering in the heat haze on the horizon.
Wesley was a bit of a drifter. High-achieving parents with plenty of money, but not much time to give to their son. That was how I read it, at least. He always said that his grandmother was more like a real mum. She gave a little laugh. I think she spoiled him rotten. Perhaps that's why he liked her so much, and why he got on so well with all his middle-aged female groupies.
How did he seem at the party?
Just as he always did, pretty chilled, making sure he got more than his fair share of the food and the wine. That was classic Wesley.
He didn't seem anxious or worried.
Janie laughed again.
Wes didn't really do anxious.
Did you notice if Nigel Yeo spoke to him at the party?
Nigel spoke to everyone when he first came in. She looked back at Jen. But you were there. You'll have seen as much as me.
Ah, Jen said. You were sober. I very much wasn't.
They walked back to the car then, stopping for the ice cream on the way. In the car, Janie started scrabbling in her bag. At last, she pulled out a scrap of paper.
There you are. That guy's registration number, the one who blocked me in.
A brief moment of triumph. Jen wasn't sure how useful the conversation had been, but when she dropped Janie back in Insto, the younger woman gave her a quick hug.
Thanks, she said. Really, you've helped a lot.
On the way back to Barnstable, Jen stopped at the filling station on the edge of Insto. According to CCTV, Nigel had stopped here for fuel on the way to Westercombe after leaving Cynthia's party. She introduced herself to a faded middle-aged woman who was perched on a tall stool behind the counter.
I don't suppose you were on duty on Friday evening?
Yeah, the graveyard shift. 8 until we closed at midnight.
CCTV shows that a man called in, Dr. Nigel Yeo. He was murdered up at Westercombe Farm later that night or early the following morning.
The woman brightened. This was a moment of excitement, as close to fame as she was likely to get.
I heard about that on the radio.
Jen got out a photograph and set it on the counter.
Do you remember him?
Yes, the last customer of the night. He said he was glad we were still open. He hadn't realised how low he was on diesel.
I told him it wouldn't do to run out at that time of night, and he said especially as he was heading out into the wilds.
Jen thought that all made sense, and it was exactly as they'd suspected.
Thanks.
She paused and thought she'd throw the woman a little titbit to make her day.
You were probably the last person, other than the killer, to see him alive.
When she walked out onto the forecourt, she turned and saw the woman was already on her phone, spreading the news to all her friends, basking in a strange sort of glory.
Chapter 23. The Patients Together offices where Nigel Yeo had been based were in Ilfracombe, not far from Hope Street. That was where Simon Walden, the victim in Matthew's first North Devon murder inquiry, had lived, and images of the case, the chaotic, quirky house and its bright, articulate residence, returned as he parked and looked down over the town. Matthew made an effort to refocus his attention on the present inquiry. He'd been allowed to take Alexander Mackenzie's notes from the hospital and had read them before setting out. He'd found little new there. There was nothing that might suddenly have triggered a need for a cover-up surrounding Mac's death. Nothing to explain a good man's murder. Or the death of an engaging, aging hippie. Matthew wasn't puzzled by Yeo's involvement in the Mackenzie suicide. Nigel had been friends with the Mackenzie family,
and he'd probably have seen Mac's suicide as a test case, an example of how the trust might have mishandled other patients who were suffering acute depression. It could be useful ammunition in his attempt to push mental health further up the agenda. No, it was Nigel Yeo's dramatic murder which was so startling and inexplicable. Matthew couldn't quite see how it could relate to Mac's death. Yeo's investigation had been ongoing. There was nothing in these notes which suggested new information. If Nigel Yeo had discovered something new, it seemed he hadn't shared it with the medics or the team at the hospital. He might, though, Matthew thought, have shared it with his colleagues at NDPT. He'd started walking down one of the steep roads leading to the high street when his phone buzzed, an unfamiliar number.
Inspector Venn, it's Fiona Radley,
the head of PR, who was so protective of Roger Pryor.
I've checked with my colleagues here. Nigel had a meeting with the end-of-life team last Friday. It started at 4 p.m, though he was a little late arriving. It was all perfectly routine. They were talking about the transition between hospital and social care, something we're determined to improve here at North Devon.
Still sending out the corporate message, even in a call to the police. Matthew continued down the steep street. It was empty apart from a cat sleeping on one of the doorsteps. Tourists didn't wander this far from the harbour. He found the office in a converted domestic house, part of an Edwardian terrace. On one side was a dentist's surgery, on the other a family home. A brass plaque on the door announced its presence and told visitors to walk in. Matthew hadn't made an appointment and wasn't even sure if anyone would be there, but a plump woman in her 40s wearing a sleeveless yellow top and a yellow skirt was sitting at a desk, fanning herself with a manila file. On the desk was a woman's magazine, which, from the front cover, had the sole purpose of celebrating the scandals of celebrities. The room was very warm. She seemed surprised to see him. He introduced himself.
You'll be here about poor Nigel.
She wore large, heavy-rimmed specs, took them off and wiped her eyes. Matthew could see no tears.
I wasn't sure what I should do this morning, but I thought I should come in anyway. I phoned one of the board members and he said to keep things ticking over until they find a new boss.
What's your role, Ms.? Matthew paused.
Bull. Steph Bull. Admin officer, they call me, but really general dog's body. I answer the phone, man reception, do the filing and printing, make sure everyone's diaries are up to date, take minutes at meetings.
How many other people are employed here?
Three more. Julie, Tony and Lauren. They're all part-time and nobody else is in on a Monday. Julie and Tony work mostly with community groups. Lauren does the fundraising and finance, but she seems to have become Nigel's right-hand woman, working with him on his pet projects.
From her tone, Matthew guessed that Steph and Lauren Miller were not best friends. I'm not entirely sure what the NDPT does. Matthew sat in the chair on the public side of the desk. Perhaps you could explain.
We're here to represent the patient's views to the medical institutions.
A pause.
We work with local authorities and patient groups as a kind of coordinating body and feed our findings back to the hospitals and primary care trusts.
And does investigation into individual negligence cases usually form a part of your work?
Not until Nigel arrived.
She snapped her lips shut, as if frightened she might reveal too much. Perhaps she didn't want to appear to be speaking ill of the dead.
Before he retired, Philip was in charge, a lovely man. He saw his role as different, more supportive to the medical trusts, providing information to improve their services. His style was more...
She paused again.
Collaborative.
And Nigel wasn't collaborative. Matthew thought he knew what was going on here. The previous boss had been after a quiet life in the run-up to retirement. He'd disliked confrontation. Then along came Nigel with his medical training, more energy and more confidence, generating more work for the staff, who'd had a very easy life under the old regime.
He said our role was to shake things up, look at better ways of doing things, represent the patients more actively. He left Julie and Tony doing the routine community engagement and took on the more active inquiries.
What about Lauren Miller?
Oh, she was brought in by Nigel and she was a true believer. I suppose she said all the right things to get the job. Before her, we had Millie. She took redundancy after the first month. She'd been here for years and couldn't adapt to the new ways.
Steph looked over her glasses.
I did say she should stick it out because she only had a year to retirement, but she couldn't face the pressure. She said the stress was getting her down.
And the stress was about Nigel suggesting the organization take on a more challenging role.
No, Millie wouldn't have had much to do with that, except making sure we had the funds to cover it. No, it was Nigel getting an auditor in to look at the books. A legal requirement, apparently, though Philip hadn't seemed to see the need.
Matthew nodded. He suspected that Millie had been incompetent rather than fraudulent, but it wouldn't hurt to talk to Lauren again. If you could let me have the other staff's contact details. Steph looked at her phone and rattled off mobile numbers and email addresses.
Julie and Tony live locally, but Lauren's out in Appledore.
From her tone, the town could have been at the other end of the country.
She uses it as an excuse to work from home one day a week.
This was obviously another niggling resentment. Matthew wondered how Nigel had survived the poisonous atmosphere of the NDPT office. He found it tricky enough to manage his own team. Ross May, with his allegiance to Superintendent Joe Oldham, and impulsive Jen Rafferty with her flashes of temper. Steph turned her attention back to the magazine and to fan herself again with the file. The flab beneath her upper arm wobbled as it moved. He found himself fascinated by it and forced himself to turn away. We came across a number in Nigel's diary, Matthew said. 8531 or 8537. Does that mean anything to you? Could it be a reference for a case, a file? She shook her head.
Doesn't mean anything to me.
She'd given the matter very little thought. Matthew persisted. On Friday morning, Nigel had a meeting in the hospital. He was there later in the day. I understand it was a routine session.
Oh yeah, that was another of his particular interests, end-of-life care. I suppose it was personal because of the way his wife died. Tragic.
There was no evidence in her voice that she'd shared Yo's sadness or his interest in the subject.
He'd started looking into care homes too. As if we didn't have enough to do.
So, that confirms Radley's phone call. The later meeting had nothing to do with Alexander Mackenzie. Nigel had bumped into Ratner Joshi by chance in the hospital, just as she said. And what was he doing between those meetings?
No idea.
She shrugged.
We were expecting him back in the office, but he never turned up. He didn't even bother ringing in.
Matthew stood up. All the other people in Yo's life had been devastated by his death, but this woman seemed not to care. He'd reached the door when she spoke again.
He wasn't a saint, you know. Not the man everyone thought he was. It's all very well having principles, but not everyone's as bright or driven as him. We got the impression that he cared more about his ideals than he did about us.
Chapter 24. On his way back to the police station, Matthew stopped at the woodyard. The back of the building was still taped off, and a constable stood there, red-faced and bored, but the centre was just opening after a morning of shutdown. Matthew went in with the elderly ladies carrying yoga mats. He overheard gossip about the killing.
Liz said it was Wesley Curnow that got killed. Such a gentle soul. I bought some art from him at the Christmas craft fair.
Makes you think, though. Maureen cancelled this morning, just in case.
I doubt if a killer's going to come into the yoga class.
There was a ripple of laughter.
Well, you never know. I thought twice about coming.
This voice was anxious, almost panicky.
And after what happened here earlier in the year, it's a strange sort of coincidence, isn't it?
The women moved on through the building, and then the entrance hall was almost empty. Emptier than it should have been on a weekday morning. That was something else for Jonathan to worry about, Matthew thought. He ran the woodyard on a shoestring and couldn't afford for freelance classes to cancel. It had been hard enough recently to keep the place going. He found his husband in the cafe, chatting to the staff. The night before, there'd still been a tension between them, but now Jonathan looked up and gave one of his wide, wonderful smiles. Lucy Braddock was there. She'd been wiping tables, and there was still a cloth in her hand. She was anxious, agitated, and Jonathan was trying to calm her.
Nothing bad will happen to you, Luce, I promise. It's not like last time. Wesley was my friend, she said. I'm sad. Not worried about me.
When did you last see him? Matthew knew Lucy well, and they too were friends.
Yesterday. He was in here yesterday, waiting for someone.
She looked at Bob, the cafe manager.
Wasn't he?
Bob shrugged. I didn't notice him, but it was manic busy until mid-afternoon.
Did you see him with anyone else, Luce?
Jonathan asked.
She shook her head. He went off on his own.
How do you know he was waiting for someone? Lucy thought about that.
He often met people in here. He'd sit and wait with the free newspaper, and sometimes he'd get a coffee, and then someone would come and buy him lunch.
A pause.
Or a cake. He liked Bob's cakes.
Matthew smiled. And these people he met, were they all women? She nodded, as if the idea was new to her.
Yeah, all women.
Did you recognize any of them? Lucy frowned.
Some of them were regulars, but I don't know their names.
If I show you a photo, would you recognize them?
I don't know.
Matthew saw that the anxiety was setting in again.
It wouldn't be like a test, he said. More like a game.
He paused.
You could have your dad with you if that would help. I don't live with my dad now.
She gave a beam. For a moment the anxiety was forgotten.
I've got my own place.
Jonathan smiled. It's in Riverbank, isn't it, Luce? Supported living.
Home sweet home.
Another big smile. I bet your dad misses you. Matthew had come to know Morris Braddock too. He was in his 80s, a widower, and he loved the bones of his learning disabled daughter. Loved her enough, Matthew thought now, to let her go.
I sometimes go and stay at his house at weekends, Lucy conceded. He likes the company.
So I might bring in some pictures for you to look at.
You can come to my flat if you like, she said. I'll make you a cup of tea.
After leaving the woodyard, Matthew drove on to Westercombe. He felt unable to settle and hated the thought of going back to his overheated office in the police station before he needed to be there for the evening briefing. It was late afternoon now and the roads were quiet, everything washed with sunlight. The fields were so dry after weeks of drought that they were white, as if they'd been treated with lime. Matthew thought of Frank Lay. When Matthew had broken the news of Wesley's death, he hadn't told Lay that they suspected the murder weapon was a piece of glass which, only the day before, had stood in the comfortable living room in Westercombe House. Perhaps now it was time to do that. As he drove into the farmyard, he saw the Greaves twins. They were playing on a swing hanging from a tree beside the family's cottage. One girl was sitting on the swing and the other was standing behind her, rocking, so it jerked from side to side. They were shrieking with laughter. He thought how idyllic their child had seemed. He'd been an only child, growing up in a family where laughter was in short supply. His mother had usually disapproved of his friends, so he'd grown up with the notion that he was different, even superior in some way. No wonder the other kids in the class had disliked him and stayed clear. He moved round the house to Lay's front door and knocked, but there was no answer. Matthew had asked him to stay in Westercombe for a few days rather than going to his London home, but of course that had been a request, not some form of house arrest. The man could be working, visiting one of his other businesses, but his absence made Matthew uneasy, jittery. Again, he couldn't face going back to the police station in Barnstable, especially while he was so anxious, so jumpy. He thought he'd wait for a while to see if Lay returned. He walked towards the end of Lay's land. Jonathan would have been able to name the shrubs, the swathes of blooms in the beds, but they were mysterious to Matthew, and he felt that he'd wandered into some strange and secret garden. Like the Greaves' cottage, it was the stuff of fiction. The sweet smell of the flowers and the sounds of insects had a dreamlike quality, and Matthew thought that the police officers in the farmyard seemed to belong to a different narrative altogether. If this was Alexander Mackenzie's work, the young man had been a skilled gardener. Beyond the more formal borders, Matthew came to a wildflower meadow. It was past its best now, but still covered with buttercups, clover, and tall white daisies. There was a path through the middle where the grass had been flattened. In the distance was the sea, impossibly blue. He followed the track to a patch of heathland, separated from the meadow by a low, dry stone wall. Matthew assumed that this marked the edge of Lay's land. There was a stile over the wall, and he stood for a moment with his foot on the wooden bar, feeling a sense of freedom and adventure that he'd never experienced as a child. Closest he'd got had been the memory he'd shared with his mother of the picnics on the beach, but he'd been closely supervised then and called back if he wandered too far into the rock pools at the side of the bay. He imagined that the two girls on the swing would be allowed at least as far as the meadow by themselves. He pictured them picking armfuls of flowers and taking them home for their mother. Beyond the wall, there was rough, open land, covered with huge clumps of gorse, startlingly yellow. But the path led on and was easy to follow. It came eventually to a 5-bar gate, which opened onto the main road on the outskirts of Instow. 100 yards away, Matthew could see the unmarked turning into the paved track, which led back to the farm. The road was busier with traffic than it had been. It was the end of the working day. Matthew thought it would be perfectly possible for any of the Westercombe residents to have taken this shortcut the day before. They would have avoided the notice of the police officer at the farm entrance. They'd have needed a lift into Barnstable, or to have borrowed a car to get to the woodyard to stab Wesley Curno, but perhaps the killer had an accomplice, knowing or unknowing. Walking back through the garden to Westercombe Farm, Matthew wondered what he'd do if Frank was still absent from the place, and considered the implication of such a disappearance. Might Lay be the murderer? Or a third victim? He knew that planning ahead was his skill and his weakness. He spent too much of his time responding to disasters that never happened. Jonathan said that he had a vivid imagination. That's why you're such a brilliant detective. But you could be an artist, or a writer. When he emerged from the formal garden and onto the lawn, he saw that Lay was there, and he felt relieved and shocked at the same time. It was almost as if Lay was part of the mirage the garden had created in Matthew's mind, a fantasy figure from a piece of fiction. The man was sitting close to the house on a sun lounger with a glass in his hand. He wore a straw hat which had the look of a boater, Billy Bunter in summer issue uniform. He lifted the glass in greeting to Matthew and didn't seem surprised to see him. "I hope I wasn't trespassing," Matthew said. "I called earlier, but you were out." "Yes, a meeting with the team in the Golden Fleece in Lovercott. It's one of my businesses. They've just won an award for their hospitality, and I wanted to share the good news with the staff." Despite the celebratory nature of his visit to the pub, his tone was reflective, a little sad. "It was good to get away from all that's happened here." "You're still hands-on, then?" "Well," Lay gave a little laugh, "I share the glory, and they do all the hard work. You know how it is." "I've been exploring," Matthew said. "I found the shortcut down to Instow. Is it a public right-of-way?" "Not across the garden, though I don't mind if any of the Westercombe residents use it. Beyond the wall and the stile, it's common land and free to anyone." He looked at Matthew. "Do you think an outsider came in that way and attacked Nigel Yeo?" Matthew didn't like to say he was more concerned that one of the residents had left by the path to kill Wesley. "I'm not sure what I think yet," he said. Lay swiveled his body so he was more upright and his feet were on the ground. "Do you have any news, Inspector?" Venn sat on the low wall which surrounded the terrace. At least now he wasn't looking down on the man and they could have a proper conversation. When Eve found Wesley's body, she identified the weapon that killed him. He paused. It was a shard of glass from the vase she'd given you, the large blue vase that held the flowers which were standing in your fireplace when I first came to visit you. Of course, she might be mistaken. You might be able to find the vase for me.
"I can look," Lay said, "but I'm sure I won't find it if Eve has identified it. She's an artist. Each piece of glass is individual. It holds her signature."
"You said that Sarah might have come in to tidy the house this morning, but she said she wasn't here."
"Really? I must have been mistaken then."
He gave another little smile.
"I'm getting very absent-minded in my old age."
"Would you have any idea how the glass came to be in Wesley Curnow's workshop at the woodyard?"
"You think I killed him?"
Lay's mood was quite changed now.
He was suddenly sharper, more alert. I don't think anything, but I need to know how a piece of glass from your living room ended up in Wesley Curnow's neck.
Any of the residents could have got in. There's a door from their side of the house, and the key hangs in their ground floor kitchen. None of us is exactly security conscious.
There were lots of tools in the shed at the woodyard, potential weapons. I'm wondering why a killer would risk coming into your space and stealing the bowl. It seems unnecessarily complicated.
Some sort of message, do you think? Or perhaps the killer wanted to implicate me?
Perhaps. Or Eve. Or either of the Greaves. Is there anyone who might have a reason to do that? There was a moment of silence filled with birdsong.
I've always tried to do the right thing, Inspector. I explained that when we first met. But I haven't been popular. Some of my projects haven't worked out as I would have wished.
He paused.
There was one scheme. It caused a negative reaction. I had hate mail, threats.
What was the scheme?
There's a hamlet on the edge of Exmoor called Spennacott. The school was about to close and they'd already lost their shop. The nearest post office is 5 miles away. The community was dying, so I bought it.
What exactly did you buy?
All of it. Well, as much as I could. There were already a number of cottages for sale, too expensive for the locals. Some of them I let out at a reasonable rent to young people from the village. A few I hung on to for holiday lets to provide an income. I took over the pub and put in a manager to bring it back to life. When everyone went along with me, they knew that the new businesses would bring jobs and that would attract families into the area.
But things changed. Matthew could see how the story was moving forward.
Yes. Perhaps I moved too quickly, too dramatically. There's a big house on the edge of the village which had been turned into an old people's home years ago, and it was obvious that the business wasn't viable. Social services couldn't afford to pay the fees to keep the place running, and nor could individuals. I put in an offer. A change of management wouldn't make the care home any more profitable. The model just doesn't work. So my plan is to turn it into a boutique hotel.
Matthew thought about that. Leigh had said he was motivated by guilt, not profit, in his development projects. Couldn't you subsidise the care home to save the residents from disruption, at least for their lifetimes?
Well, I'm not sure that I could, Leigh said. It doesn't meet any of the regs. A recent inspection rated it as excellent on care, but in need of substantial improvement when it came to hygiene and facilities. The old people might love staying there, but it's probably not safe.
He paused.
Imagine how I'd feel if one of them had an accident, or there was an outbreak of food poisoning. Besides, I don't think it's right to prop up a failing business. It gives a false sense of hope if it's not going to be sustainable in the long term.
So, Matthew thought, perhaps you're not such a philanthropist after all. And it was the closure of the care home that prompted the hate mail and the threats?
Yes, there was a campaign. Not just in the village, but more widely.
Did the campaign have a leader? Matthew couldn't see how this could be relevant. Leigh hadn't been murdered, and he couldn't believe that someone with a grudge would kill 2 strangers just to implicate the financier. But he was curious.
Yes, a writer called Paul Reed. His mother was one of the care home's residents. I'm not quite sure why he was so venomous in his response.
Leigh paused.
Guilt, perhaps, because he wasn't prepared to look after his relative himself?
He looked up. As I said before, guilt is a terrible thing. Or he could just have been looking for a good story, another reputation to trash. There was a moment of silence. Matthew could tell that there was more to come.
I should probably have told you this before, but Reed involved patients together in his campaign. He said that most of the residents of the care home were NHS patients too.
So Nigel was investigating your role in closing down the home. Steph Bull, the admin officer, had said that Yeo had been passionate about the transition from hospital to social care. Matthew could see how he might get pulled into this project.
Leigh nodded. Unofficially, I think. I can't see how it was really part of his brief.
Perhaps he felt he had to follow up the complaint just because the two of us were friends and he couldn't be seen to show any favouritism. He went to visit last week, the Thursday before he died. Then waited for Leigh to give more details, but the man remained silent. What were his findings? Leigh turned back to face him.
I don't know, he said. How could I? Nigel didn't have the chance to make his report.